Dynamic and generative soundtracks are almost entirely unique to video games. Copies of films and TV shows, of course, are exactly the same whenever you watch them, but games are often designed to be approached in many ways. One experienced player could complete a level or section in record time, while another struggles with controls for 5 minutes before even getting started. At its simplest, that's going to have an effect on how long a piece of music loops for and when the theme for the next area will begin. Yet, the principle can get a lot more complicated than that. Many titles implement specific layers for fights and battles, which unmute when you initiate combat. Others will feature numerous variations on an established melody or arrangement, triggered by a player's movements through a town, for example. VGM composers have to think about such layers and how to comfortably transition between them, constantly. As I record this, dynamic music is everywhere, in some form, but it's surprising how far back it goes, and just how advanced it could be in its earliest days. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth at video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. This final part of my 3-episode LucasArts special delves into the evolution of dynamic composition through the lens of iMuse, a highly influential system that was used in many of the company's most legendary titles. Years ahead of its time, iMuse featured complicated transitions between different tracks and truly left players feeling in control of every aspect of the action. The system was first implemented by Michael Land and Peter McConnell right at the start of the 90s, and I'm pleased to be joined once more by Peter himself in his 4th Sound Test appearance. Alongside Peter, I also spoke to Clint Bajakian, who composed for many classic projects that used iMuse. The sound of LucasArts through the 90s was defined by the work of Clint and Peter, with Michael Land, and it's a true honour to include them in this podcast. However, before the development of iMuse, George Sanger worked with LucasArts on titles like Maniac Mansion, recognised as a true trailblazer for point-and-click adventures. As heard in my previous episode, George's game music even predates the industry-wide crash of 1983. But nearly 4 decades ago, dynamic music was still to be found, though admittedly in its infancy. Ball Blazer, one of LucasArts' very first releases, randomly selected small riffs and phrases to play over a central bass line, all coded by Peter Langston. Players would never hear the same version twice, although it would be a stretch to call that reactive, in a way that responds to your specific movements in-game. In the early 80s, the concept of actually reactive music in video games was fresh, and not lost on visionaries like George. At the very beginning of his career, he composed a memorable adaptive tune for Capture the Flag, released in 1983 for the Atari. The game itself was simple, tasking one player with finding a flag within a maze before a competing player can capture and stop them. In order to heighten the tension, George's theme changes as the invader and defender near each other. And the effect must have worked too, since Capture the Flag and Way Out, on which it's based, are known to have inspired John Romero during his work on Doom, Quake, and Wolfenstein 3D.
Actually, John Romero mentioned to me once that that Capture the Flag and its precursor, Way Out, Way Out was the first one. Capture the Flag is the two-player version. That those were highly influential to him when he saw that a person could be in a maze in a game, you know, something in his head exploded. And he said, wow, that can be done. Oh, okay, first person game, got it. So in a way, those were pretty influential titles. The programmer and designer and, you know, everything else, artist, all one person, as was typical in those days, Paul Edelstein, who was a relative of a friend of mine. I would go over to his house and go upstairs into his little study, and he would be programming and forth, and he would set me up with something, anything to do music on. And what we settled on was an Atari 800 cartridge called Music Composer. So I can't remember exactly how the interface was, but it's something like, you know, you type in, you know, the name of the note, F, and then comma, and then Q for a quarter note, and comma, you know, and then maybe a D if you wanted it to be a dotted quarter, and then enter. You know, it wasn't particularly graphic, at least for the input, as I recall. There wasn't anything like a mouse. The joystick wasn't being used on that game, on that experience. So a lot of typing in and a lot of backspacing, and then somehow get it to play back. And that was the, you know, that was the composing medium. The challenge was to write something in two voices that wouldn't have too much data in it, but that would be dynamic and would convey something significant for basically a split screen player versus player, you know, first person tag game, basically. So I just wrote a couple of walking bass lines, a few slow ones and a few fast ones, a couple of melodies, a couple of slow ones, a couple of fast ones, and then I passed on a bunch of rules for playback to Paul. You know, when you're just starting out, just play the slow bass lines. When you get to a certain proximity to each other, start playing the melodies on top. When you get a little closer, you switch to the faster bass lines. When you get even closer, you switch to the faster melodies. Something like that. And he implemented it, and I think it's pretty satisfying. And you can find it online. I mean, I can't claim the first or the most the first dynamic music. I mean, we all know what goes on in Space Invaders. We know and love the speeding up. I think it might have been an incremental step. You know, it might have been the most something of its time, or the first something of its time. But I've stopped claiming those so much because I've found that over and over, when I think I was the first at something, or the best at something, I look around and I realize, well, there was something else going on in Japan, or somebody actually was working very hard on that in their basement and I didn't hear about it, or I was just unaware of things. And likewise, you know, the upside of that is when I think that I've messed something up or fallen off the radar or, you know, in some other way, come up with some negative. That's usually wrong too. So I'm seldom the first or best of something, and I'm seldom the worst or forgotten of something. So that helps me take things day by day and enjoy my minutes. People don't talk about that game very much. This might be the first the deepest interview I've done about that game.
Thin Ice. Despite its obscurity, Capture the Flag is still a key title when it comes to the development of adaptive music. Unfortunately, it's all too often the case that huge swathes of 80s gaming culture are left hidden in the memories of those who lived through it, and in dusty databases that capture none of the magic. That's partly because of the 1983 crash, but by the 90s, the industry was thriving again. New ideas and innovative concepts spread like wildfire, so it's no surprise that dynamic soundtracks took a big step forward. A year before iMuse's debut, George Sanger contributed to Origin Systems' Wing Commander alongside Dave Govett. It was a significant release on a number of fronts, later influencing LucasArts themselves with their own space combat games like X-Wing. Wing Commander was particularly impressive for its use of audio, featuring strong themes that react to in-game actions and cleverly avoid repetition.
That was a miracle, really. Shortly after I had a very heady, exciting meeting with Chris Roberts, he asked me to do something like, you know, the Star Wars meets Star Trek the movie. And so I got the idea. Okay, we're talking John Williams. There hadn't been, to my knowledge, here I go again with the firsts. In my mind, nobody had impersonated John Williams yet for a video game. So we got to step in there and be the first to urinate in that pond. We got to be the first to try that, and certainly not the last. But leaving that meeting, I don't think we'd really codified what Team Fat was, but I knew Dave Govett. I'd worked with him. I knew I wanted to work with him some more. We might or might not have been calling ourselves Team Fat, but I knew that I was in a bit over my head. And I said, "Dave, what do you think about this kind of music?" He says, "Oh, yeah, I'm always thinking about that movie music. I got a couple of things in my head. Just need to write them down. Just need to put them out there." So since he had been in high school, he'd been mentally composing that opening theme for Wing Commander and the dogfight and combat music. It was just in his heart. It was in his head already. So what he turned over to me a few days later was just what you hear in the game. And there was no request to make it interactive. So later, once the project was underway a bit, Chris got back to me and said, "I'm thinking we should make this music interactive." And I'm like, "All right, let's do it." And he says, "Could you break up the combat music into your wingman has been hit, you are chasing the missile is chasing you, dire battle, you know, dire situation, you know, just a short list, must have been like 12 things, right?" So we just took that combat music and we cut it up into little sections and renamed it. And somewhere in a basement at Origin Systems was, I want to say, Herman Miller and I want to say Mark Schaefkin. And while I was thinking, here I am, the greatest of them all, this fabulous composer with this amazing team, all I was doing was actually producing in that case, and then later writing, some MIDI tunes on an MT32. But these other guys were slaving away, turning it into FM tones, turning it into dynamic music, and hooking up the engine so that the playback would actually happen the way that you hear it. A couple of interesting sidebars on that. When Wing Commander was unveiled at a CES show, it was the hit of the show with its, especially with its dynamic soundtrack. But they were not playing a dynamic soundtrack. They were telling you it was a dynamic soundtrack. They were showing combat, and they were playing the music exactly as Dave had composed it. Later it became a dynamic soundtrack, and it was nearly as effective and musical. But the psychoacoustics of the CES show made it the hit of that show. Just as the Valpaint program had been the hit of the show when it was unveiled in 1983 or 4. So it was fun. Everyone should be the hit of the trade show just once or twice in their lives.
Wing Commander eventually spawned a whole franchise of expansions, ports, and sequels, solidifying itself as an important pillar of gaming history. But LucasArts already boasted a growing reputation in 1990, and was just about to embark on an entire decade packed with beloved releases. They started strong with titles like Loom and The Secret of Monkey Island, soon followed by its sequel, Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, the first game to implement iMuse. The distinctive pirate reggae that scores the series had already been established by Michael Land's music for the original release, though he'd be joined for the second by his friends Clint Bajakian and Peter McConnell.
Michael, when we were back in Boston, and during that time where we were both working at Lexicon and playing in, we played in a band together. I did forget to mention that. He did some work with a guy named Josiah. Can't remember the guy's last name, but he was one of the original Whalers. And so he actually learned directly from the source how to play reggae. And it was sort of a real wonderful bit of serendipity that, you know, his first really big composition gig was to write pirate reggae music. So he was completely, you know, made to do that in some ways. And so he really set the tone for Monkey 2. And Woodtick was meant to be a showcase for a certain type of interactivity in iMuse, which is, we called it the beat synchronous transition, so that unlike any system before that, what would happen when you did when you wanted to go to a new piece of music, you go to a new situation, you know, you open up a door, and there's, you know, the crusty old pirate, and he's got his crusty old pirate theme. What iMuse did was it waited until the next beat or the next musically appropriate place to make the transition, rather than making the transition right away. So we had this sort of metaphor of the pit orchestra, and if you've ever played in a pit orchestra for a musical, which I did in high school, and that probably also informed my take on this stuff, is that the conductor is going to be looking on the stage. You have music in front of you, and you're playing it, and they're up there singing Bye Bye Birdie or whatever, and the scene changes, and the conductor will occasionally, depending on how things go, just kind of whisper, you know, bar 35, right? And slow things down or pick up the pace or actually go to a new place in the music based on what's happening on the stage. And that's all based on what's musically appropriate as well as what's going on in the drama. And with iMuse, that was our goal. And WoodTick was a really, it was meant to showcase the idea of we're not going to change the music just because something happened. We're going to be musical about responding to what just happened. So, yeah, that was, and you know, I can't remember how long it took him to compose and code that up, but it was quite a piece of work to do. The other thing I would say that he, major bit of music that really showed off the system that Michael did was the voodoo lady music. When you go through the swamp, and as you go through the swamp, you get closer to the voodoo lady's place. All these parts add into this. You have this sort of simple voodoo lady theme. That's very, it's like what they would call an ostinato in the classical world. It's a short piece that repeats, and you can build on it like Pachelbel's canon, right? And you start out with just one melody, and as you go through the swamp, more and more melodies get added, and more instruments, until you reach the voodoo lady's actual, domain, abode. And that was another thing that Michael did.
He was, he's a very earnest and intelligent man. And he was describing to me some of the angst, the 10 years and $1 million that they spent creating the iMuse system and getting the transitions, the system for the transitions just right. And then it was so ironic that when Monkey Island came out, the transitions would happen. You wouldn't even know that you were going from one style of music into another style of music when you go into the voodoo shop or whatever it was. And just like me, I start laughing at him and say, you know, well, actually, you know what you could have done? You could have just cut the piece up and done hard transitions. You know, maybe the player needs to hear a transition happen right when they click the mouse so that they know that it happened and so that they can feel that they caused it. So I was throwing this theoretical garbage at him, right in his painful spots. I hope I didn't really cause any tears. I don't think I did. But we had a good time kind of joking about those things. There were times when he felt that when he was when his team was building iMuse, as it got more and more complex, he would paint these pictures of being at the top. He said, you know what it's like, George? You know what it's like? It's like being, like you're building a skyscraper and you've got a, you're up on one of the beams and you've got a megaphone and you're calling down to the ground, I think you're going to need another beam, maybe a 12-footer, and they send one up and you put it there, but you've got no blueprint. You're just building where you think you need it at that point. And so the complexity and the earnesty and the effort that they put into that, and contrasted to what we did with Wing Commander, on my side, not counting what Miller and Shafkin did and what was going on under the hood, it made for a very interesting and fun dynamic between me and the LucasArts team. So they were the when we would get together and hang out, they would sort of play the role of the academic, intellectual, scientific, precise version of the Three Stooges.
While George Sanger had some reservations about iMuse at first, it soon made a name for itself as a unique and satisfying way of presenting dynamic audio. The sound of its transitions became synonymous with LucasArts point-and-click adventures for the entire decade to come. iMuse was even adapted for use in other genres, like the arguably more complicated space combat of certain Star Wars games. Having been initially designed by Michael Land and Peter McConnell, who remained central to the company through the 90s, iMuse continued to evolve. Along with Clint Bajakian, they're responsible for the vast majority of scores written for the system. As covered in my previous episode, all three did have some background with audio programming before their time at LucasArts, but Clint was new to the concept of adaptive music.
It was very exciting getting going with the iMuse system, which it was written with a small italic I and then capital M-U-S-E, stood for Interactive Music and Sound Effects. And Michael really was the principal inventor, but Peter McConnell partnered up with him, and so it was really a joint effort between the two of them. And later, Michael McMahon helped as a programmer and engineer as well. It was all very sophisticated programming code. When I first joined LucasArts, of course, I had no experience whatsoever working in an interactive format. And I did know how to MIDI sequence, though. I was familiar with computers and with MIDI sequencing, which helped a lot. And when I joined LucasArts in 91, the two titles that were being worked on were Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, and Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. And so we, all three of us, contributed music to both those titles, which was typical for us over the decade to follow on most titles. I remember writing a simple little tune, but then it needed to be incorporated into the iMuse system. That system, in a nutshell, which is hard to do because it was a complicated system, it ran on the Macintosh in the authoring environment, and there were numerous components that all talked to each other over something called the MIDI manager. And it was, I believe, from Opcode MIDI systems back then. And so effectively, it was like a switchboard that the different, your MIDI sequencer, there was a HyperCard stack that had different functions that you could bring up, set the parameters, and then hit a send button with your MIDI sequencer in record mode, and it would blast a SysX message through that internal bus architecture, and now you would have this, you know, 40-character SysX message residing kind of like a marker in your MIDI stream, in your MIDI sequencer, and you could place it on whatever bar and beat you wanted. That was the basis for the MIDI file once incorporated into the runtime architecture of the game, functioning according to the interactive rules and connective rules and procedures that you had set up. Just to give you a quick example, there were things called jump hooks, and that would be a SysX message, and you would place it, if you wanted the music to transition from wherever you were in this composition to a, let's say, a transition composition that then took you to yet another composition, because something happened in the game to warrant that transition, you would put a jump hook, for example, every downbeat of every bar, which ensured that the exit from that piece of music was on an even beat, on a downbeat, and not in the middle of some beat, which would sound potentially not musical and not smooth. And once the system sent a jump message to the iMuse system because, let's say, the drawbridge opened. Okay, so when the drawbridge opens, the system sends the iMuse, the game host, we used to call it the host, sends the iMuse system a jump hook with a value of 17, because that's what you specified would be sent when the drawbridge opens. And that comes in the IMU system. It says, hey, jump 17. And the next time a message goes by in the MIDI stream that answers that description, then the sequence that you've set up and the rules and procedures, like the destination of that jump hook, all that you had set in the hypercard stack when you first blasted that sysx message in the authoring environment, it gets executed. And that's just one example. We could set volumes of parts, of pieces of music. As you got closer to the Voodoo Lady's shack in the swamp in Monkey 2, certain instruments would get louder and come into the mix. Cowbells or shakers or, you know, different instruments. And then if you got far away again, they'd decrease in volume.
Right out of the gate, iMuse was a successful and intriguing way of handling dynamic audio. Michael, Clint, and Peter felt inspired by the challenge it presented and constantly worked to push its limits. However, adaptive elements weren't the only complication they had to deal with. Alongside worries about the player's movement, composers for early 90s computer games had to consider the player's actual setup. Thanks to the digital audio revolution, all modern home computers are essentially identical in the way they play back music. 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. Instead, a wide variety of sound cards with different capabilities were available. Some used the most rudimentary of waveforms, with barely any channels, while others could make full use of FM synthesis. How do you approach composing music that's certain to sound drastically different depending on the player's hardware?
While in theory there were standards so that a piece of music would in theory sound the same on all cards, Larry the O, one of our other audio guys in the LucasArts department, said, the difference between theory and practice is that in theory there is no difference. So in practice, we basically had to polish separate versions of the score for a number of different sound cards. And it was, we did a G-MIDI version, a Roland MT32 version, and an Adlib or Sound Blaster version of all those MIDI scores.
This is a philosophical question, that doesn't really apply anymore today, but back then it totally did, which is, do you write your music and conceive of it and compose it into the quote target format that your audience is going to be experiencing, or do you compose into a superior environment that maybe 1% of your audience has gone and bought the expensive sound card that has the better sounding instruments? Do you write into that higher quality environment? We answered that question across the board, the latter. We wanted to work at a higher level of sonic quality where the instruments were more realistic, there was reverb on them, it sounded more pleasing to the ear, and you were more inspired as a creator working in that higher level of quality. And then those pieces had to be adapted to the target format, which was generally four operator FM synthesis, which is, as you may know, very primitive in its ability to replicate musical instruments, particularly things like strings and brass.
Before CD audio came along, you'd truly reap the rewards if you owned the right sound card. LucasArts professionals worked hard to make sure soundtracks sounded good across all systems. But the improvement was clear with high-end hardware. For a while, the very best choice on the market was Roland's MT32, originally released as an external synthesizer for bands and pop musicians. It soon made a name for itself in the world of VGM, though, capable of producing far more pleasing tones than FM synthesis and simple waveforms. As a true innovator in the field, George Sanger was of course among the first to make use of an MT32 in games. So what's his background with the module, and what made it so special?
I did not buy it as a sound card. I bought it because there was an ad in Mix Magazine that I could get, you know, 8 synthesizers in one. In one little module. And I thought, well, this is what I need. So I picked it up so that I could compose for MIDI for karaoke and for these voice teachers and songwriters. And I found this was a great time in my life because I found that just by writing to this thing on this system, I could finally sculpt, after having a fairly frustrating time as a musician, as a music major. I'm not very good at keyboards, and I'm really not that fantastic at any real-time music. I love to jam, but I'm not a great player. But I always thought that maybe if I could move the notes around a little bit and put them in the right place and sculpt them, that I could come up with something. So that system, having 8 voices and MIDI notes, the dream came true, and I realized, yes, I actually can do that.
There was an MT32 card, and there was the separate MT32 unit, which you could play with a MIDI interface. For our purposes, the drivers were only slightly different. Because talking to the LAPC1 card, I think that's what it's called again, was very similar to sending MIDI notes out to a separate unit. And we loved that. And then that sort of became supplanted by the Sound Canvas because of the use of sample technology. But there was an era where and I'll get back to that in a second, but there was an era where the MT32 was just the tippy top of things. And I think it's worth mentioning kind of the musical context of the time, because it was about 1990, and the MT32 had been around, I don't know exactly when it came out, but I'm going to say late 80s at the earliest. And it was definitely an offshoot of something called the Roland D50, which was a synthesizer of choice for a lot of sort of pop and new wave bands in the 80s. There was this whole, if you were a fan of 80s music at all, the electronic component had a really distinctive sound. And that sound had to do with this explosion of synthesizer technology that happened in the mid to late 80s. And see, I'm sort of lucky because I came in, I got out of school and I came into the working world just when that MIDI thing was taking off, when digital audio and MIDI was this really big thing, and you had companies like Lexicon to give an idea of sort of the synthesis technology that we're talking about in the MT32. Came from, as I said, and it went, MT32 was a Roland, was made by the Roland company, Japanese synthesizer company. They also made something called Roland D50, and there was another corresponding unit made by a company called Korg, the Korg M1. And just every band had one of these, and it was this sort of and it was wavetable synthesis, which is not quite the same as sample synthesis. What wavetable synthesis does is it starts with an attack, which may be a sample, or it may not, and then it uses a synthesized tone to but it has this little wave that's using as the attack, and then it generates for the full part of the tone a synthesized sound using oscillators.
So you'd get the chirp at the beginning of a violin attack, and then you'd get a nice sawtooth oscillator taking over for the sustain. Some studies had been done that show that a lot of your recognition of what an instrument is or what a sound is happens in the very first impact of the of what you hear. So if you hear, you might not identify it as a violin, but if you hear, you know, if you hear that chirp of the rosin of the bow, you might identify it as the correct instrument, or the chiff of a flute. So that's where you start getting your great shakuhachi, you know, your choo. You get start getting those forbidden sounds, overused sounds, but you get a little chiff of a sample, and then you get an analog oscillator continuing the tone, ooh, or ee. So it was a delight to work with.
The Roland D50, that sound resulted in a lot of sort of breathy, rich flute and string sounding sounds, which were a huge part of pop music of the 80s. And the Roland MT32 was that in a box. So it had this kind of pop music lineage to it. And it was, you know, something that only a very few gamers would have. That's we got a little bit of grief from our management for spending too much time on our MT32 work because it was a very small part of the market, you know. But that market did include, say, Steven Spielberg, who was an avid gamer, and so we always, you know, whenever we were, you know, we're done with a product, it would, you know, version of it would go to Steven, and he'd send us back a nice letter of how much, you know, he enjoyed Monkey Island 2 or whatever. But, you know, besides Steven Spielberg and a few lawyers and doctors, there probably weren't a ton of them out there. But they did nevertheless define, partly because of this cultural connection, I think, that I just mentioned in terms of the pop music world, they kind of defined the sound of games from that era.
The MT32 broke open the possibility of something that might actually sound good. I'm going to say, you know, FM started to give you polyphony, but the MT32 was something that you might listen to and say, you know, I like these tones. Now, I may be mischaracterizing it, and there are people who love their FM. But the MT32 was something that people would have considered a legit synthesizer, and was also theoretically sitting in people's houses and playing back music on their PCs. Now, in practice, to what extent did that actually happen? I really don't know, and I'd love to find out. I think that a lot of what happened was that the MT32 was used in trade shows. There might have been some people with a lot of disposable income who would get one and show it to their friends, but how many of those people there were, I really couldn't say. It started going out as a, you know, in different colors. You know, instead of the black one, they started putting out a beige one. They put it out in a sound card format, I'm pretty sure. Tell me if I'm wrong. You know, with some small compromises in the sound. I'm thinking of the Sound Canvas at this point. So it was considered a sound card. Was it, in practical reasons, actually a sound card? Maybe. But it got people thinking, hey, this actually is a machine on which we can do artistic stuff. And this was happening right around the time, you know, if you think about Loom, one of the very first MT32 soundtracks, and remember what the ad said, that it had art by real artists. So, you know, and music by real musicians too, if you count Tchaikovsky as a real musician, which I would.
With the MT32 and General MIDI, classical instrumentation and influences became a lot easier to emulate. As covered in the sound test previously, orchestral-inspired VGM goes right back to pieces like Trap by Ben Daglish, written for the Commodore 64's SID chip. Yet, until the richer timbres of MIDI became prevalent, even the best game music had trouble synthesizing strings, or particularly, brass. The best you could get was a tone that, at most, suggested a violin, but those distinctive chip sounds have their own appeal. They'd have to, too, since most players simply couldn't afford an MT32, either as a card or separate module. For those who could, a whole new world of more realistic patches became available, and it was exactly those that allowed George to really innovate with soundtracks like Loom. The full-blown digital audio revolution was still a few years away though, so even top-tier hardware was at the mercy of channel and memory limitations.
When it came down to voices, then I just, voice dropouts, that was the biggest difficulty that I remember. So I would take a pass through it for tempos. Then I would take another pass through it for voice balance. And then I would listen to what was left. And if it sounded pretty decent, even with the dropouts, I would leave it alone and let God sort it out. If it was giving me trouble and it sounded like dropouts that were not sounding musical and were interrupting the flow, I would dig around frantically for which voices of the MT32 were using multiple oscillators, and I would switch it over to other voices that used fewer oscillators. I would cut out voices that were doubling anything. I just kind of dipped into my vague recollections of orchestration class and say, what would a real orchestrator do if they were doing a reduction for a smaller ensemble? And it's really just kind of practical matters. If there's doubling going on, you reduce the amount of doubling. If there's if there are spots where you just want to make sure that the three notes of the triad are covered, or if there's an important moving part, you just kind of listen to it and go, what's important here? And take out what isn't. And eventually you get something that sounds happy. And your ear, if there's so much melody and so much feeling and so much emotion in that music, that your heart will forgive what your ear catches. Oh, you know what was really fun was doing Star Trek 25th anniversary on that, because I got to do all the iconic Star Trek music, and I got to use it as a sound effects generator to imitate all the sound effects for Star Trek. And I found that I was for the original, TOS, the original series, and I found that I was able to make all the communicator noises, transporters, everything, even a pretty convincing bridge ambience, just using the MT32. And I got pretty close using FM, in all fairness, too. But that was a real test. That was, I think, my master work, my master project, my favorite project for just doing constructing sounds from synthesis only. So so the MT32 for me, you know, to my mind, was a breakthrough in being able to get actually listenable Tchaikovsky to gamers, to get listenable fake John Williams to gamers. I'm sure that Sierra Online was doing some pretty cool things with it as well. And it was kind of a renaissance from our point of view as composers and sound designers.
Whether you were lucky enough to own an MT32 or played with a simple Adlib chip, there had to be some way for that hardware to communicate with the game's software. iMuse itself is an example of such a system, but around the same time, John Miles released the Audio Interface Library, now known as the Miles Sound System. Since its introduction, it's been used across countless games, and both George Sanger and the MT32 contributed to its early development. Although the Miles sound system is unrelated to LucasArts directly, it's such a key part of VGM history that I simply had to ask George about his involvement with it.
John asked if there were any suggestions I had for a system, and I said, yes, if you want to make it easy for the composers, and the way to do that is make your system emulate an MT32. So it should have 8 channels. The 8th channel should be percussion. When you call program change 1, it should bring up a piano sound, etc. And so he did that. So the first versions of the Miles sound system have that. And I created a set, you know, with my team member, Kevin Phelan. I created a set of tones that would make the FM sound like an MT32. So people could hook up an MT32 or they could hook up an FM synthesizer and it would sound the same for a given MIDI file. Then later, at Seventh Guest, this new thing called General MIDI came up and we converted it over so that the MT32 and the FM were emulating General MIDI. It's important to kind of point out to a modern audience that before General MIDI and the sound canvas and Seventh Guest, you would get a MIDI file and it would play back any old way. So you would play back a MIDI file and you would have to set up whatever was playing back that file to have piano on the piano track, to have drums on the drum track, to have a bass on the bass track. But then independently, I came up with the idea, well, if it's imitating the MT32, we can use these program changes to bring up these sounds. So that was successful. And then Roland similarly, and I think independently, came up with that idea to do that for General MIDI, so it would imitate the sound canvas.
As George describes, advanced electronics were once as important to VGM as the composition itself. Many modern game musicians, and particularly demo sceners, still roll their sleeves up and dig into such technicalities. But it's arguably easier today to get started. In many ways, that's a good thing, and has led to a huge variety of great music in contemporary titles. Professionals like George, Clint, and Peter had a lot of concerns that, by and large, no longer exist. Since we've discussed the MT32 and how exclusive it was, what exactly were the alternatives? Most players would have to make do with the FM synthesis of chips like the Adlib, and in some cases, even simpler hardware.
So not only did we do it for the ad lib, but on the first title that we did iMuse for, which was Monkey Island, we did it for PC Speaker. Now, PC Speaker, for all of you geeks out, retro geeks out there who like to look at an old MS-DOS machine, the PC Speaker had two commands, in and out. And what we had to do was write a driver that could translate a MIDI tone into a series of a MIDI note, right, into a series of commands that would make the speaker go in and out. So it was as nuts and bolts as you can possibly imagine. And honestly, I didn't do that, so I don't know how it worked. It was pretty arcane. The ad lib, writing for the ad lib, that's a little more straightforward in the sense that it's just a synthesizer card. It happens to be FM based. You can, a great part of doing good ad lib music was getting the right patches and being able to tweak the patches. And tweaking patches in FM synthesis, for anyone who's done it, it is kind of a black art, because changing how frequencies modulate each other is the results of the changes you make are not at all obvious. So you'll change what some oscillator is doing in the patch, and you just get this result that's like, oh, I didn't know that was going to sound like the Taco Bell, but it does. The real sort of black art, as it were, of working with FM synthesis was to find a way to really work on the patch set, on the sample set, and not sample set, but the programs that you're using to make a particular instrument sound on the card, and tweaking those so that they're as rich and you know, so that the bass sounds something like a bass, so that the clarinet sounds, yeah, okay, I could believe that in is sort of clarinetish. and one of the hardest things was the French horns, because they just ended up sounding like a squeeze box. But then there's ways of doing a percussion too, which are, it sort of sounds like, you know, for a big orchestral snare drum. That's about what you can get out of it. But a lot of the work that we did, writing a driver that operates an ad lib or a sound blaster card, is not a huge effort. Technically speaking, it's just kind of a doable thing. And to send, okay, I'm going to send this patch to the sound card, and it's going to play this. But actually doing it in such a way, the real sort of work was really done by the composer, which was to what parameters are you actually sending to the sound card to make it have that sound? What are you doing to try to emulate a French horn? And we used to, no disrespect intended, we used to call it polishing a turd, because you would spend hours and hours getting a slightly, ever so slightly, less awful sounding French horn or trombone. But, you know, you were like, okay, that's fatter. That's slightly fatter. That's somehow a relief from what it was before, which sounded like a rubber band plucked over a toilet seat. You know, we just really were against using anything off the shelf, because the sound cards were so limited that you just wanted to strain the teensiest little bit of quality that you could out of it. And the only way you could do that was to roll up your sleeves and make it happen. And besides, the off-the-shelf tools were pretty few and far between and had limitations that did not make them compatible with our interactive approach, with our middleware, which was the iMuse system. So It was necessity is the mother of invention. So it was a necessity that we had to work on those sounds ourselves. And then there was another level of polishing. Once having created the sound set and authoring the piece, there was a final round of polishing where you just tweaked every little velocity you could in the MIDI file to have each note be as present as possible and as meaningful as possible, because again you're trying to strain blood out of a turnip. I'm going to use all these metaphors for getting the most excellent bad sound you can. and clearly it played off because people still like those games and speak fondly and of oh man, I remember when I first opened that box, or my dad played it with me. This is mostly what I get now.
Since the days of General MIDI and FM synthesis, people's nostalgia for those tones has crystallized into a thriving chiptune and retro scene. The advent of CD audio meant that such synthesis was slowly phased out in favor of real instrumentation, with a growing emphasis on orchestration and licensed pop music. That evolution also had a profound effect on the use of voice and sound effects. Explosions, for example, no longer relied on sculpting white noise as they did in the days of simple synthesis, and actual recordings became more common. Realistic sound effects were a huge factor in the ever-increasing immersion of video games. So much so that they're often taken for granted today.
Early in the 90s, the sound, I believe it was called the Sound Blaster, actually had a little digital audio chip. And you could now have tiny, because the RAM and your shipping medium was floppy disks, and so you really were limited in many ways. But you could have some tiny audio files that would play on this audio chip. That opened the door, as primitive as it was, to now being able to design a sound that wasn't just a four operator FM synthesis patch, if you will, where you set your different parameters and now it sounds like a burst of white noise, and that's your explosion, right? That's about all you got, is an envelope and a burst of white noise for your explosions, etc. But now you could actually use a sound effects library and take a recording of an actual explosion and, of course, convert it down to a very low sample rate and a very small file size and ship an actual recording of an explosion in your game. And, of course, as the 90s progressed, more and more was possible with digital audio. So for me, that was a very exciting opportunity. And of the three of us, given the duties that we each had, I mean, Michael ran the department as a manager. He and Peter also were responsible for maintaining and updating the iMuse system, which was a very intensive thing. We all always had music to write. And so I ended up being the one of the three of us that rolled up his sleeves and kind of got into sound design and convinced management to buy sound effects libraries and all that. And I will tell you, an unbelievably fortunate thing for me was our rapport that we had with Skywalker Sound and the talent at Skywalker Sound. And we became friends with Gary Rydstrom, who did the sound design for Saving Private Ryan, Titanic, Jurassic Park. I mean, some of the most blockbuster sound design films. And we would occasionally have lunch with Gary, and he would tell us war stories and tell us about how he hired a man with reptiles to come to the ranch and there were reptiles crawling all over his studio, and he was recording them for Jurassic Park and their breath and things like that. And so I learned so much just having lunch with Gary from time to time. And I would try to interpolate from the different stories that he would tell and synthesize it for myself into, these are the types of things I need to be doing.
We developed the iMuse system quite fully to include digital audio later. So, and we preferred to use digital audio. the initial system was all MIDI because the Sound Blaster card was just coming out. The digital audio portion of Monkey 2, and there was a very, very tiny digital audio version of Monkey 2, basically involved Largo going, or spitting. I think the spitting was actually a Sound Blaster sound. We had a few choice things where if you happened to have that new audio card, you could hear digital audio playing with a MIDI. Monkey Island 2 and Fate of Atlantis, Indiana Jones, The Fate of Atlantis, we called it Indy 4, and Sam and Max Hit the Road were all MIDI scores. Those were really the... they weren't the only MIDI scores. We could also, a big part of that was X-Wing and TIE Fighter. Those were also MIDI scores. And boy, let me tell you, it's really, really quite a challenge to reduce John Williams' Star Wars theme to something that can play back on a Sound Blaster, which was my job. But the titles that I mentioned, basically Monkey 2, Dot, Day of the Tentacle, I missed that one, sorry. Sam and Max Hit the Road, X-Wing and TIE Fighter. That was pretty much the sum total of our MIDI work at LucasArts. If you don't count some things like Shadows of the Empire, which was a special case because it was for a particular platform. Beyond that, we went into digital audio, and the big sort of transition day came, I think it was... it's got to be right after Sam and Max Hit the Road, that Vince Lee, who was a sort of a genius programmer at LucasArts, he showed us this thing that he was working on called Rebel Assault, where you could fly an X-Wing and you heard John Williams' music playing. And that really just changed everything for us, because even though it was... really chunky graphics, and even though it was 8-bit 11K mono sound, it was a real orchestra, and the impact of a real orchestra at 8K 11-bit mono is, for certain kinds of music, not all kinds, but for certain kinds, sorry to say, way more impactful than the best MIDI synthesizers you can get. And the stuff that we were interested in doing for things, you know, some of the titles that were coming up, really made it a sort of a necessity that we really understand digital audio. So we did, and we implemented most of the features in iMuse over the course of maybe 4 years or so. We implemented most of the features of iMuse in to digital audio format. So you will hear that the first title we did that with was Full Throttle, which was my project.
For iMuse, Full Throttle was an important release. The digital audio format allowed Peter to break new ground with his soundtrack, which actually included music licensed from outside artists. Such an arrangement was a rarity at LucasArts, who took understandable pride in their native composers. For many in 1995, it was both unusual and exciting to hear the Gone Jackals blasting out when playing the game, accompanied throughout by Peter's original tunes. As for sound effects, Clint Bajakian used a multitude of real recordings to similarly make the most of digital audio, resulting in one of LucasArts' most advanced sounding titles from the time. The power of CDs even allowed all that to fit alongside extensive voice acting from the likes of Mark Hamill, Maurice LaMarche, and Tress MacNeille. If you haven't heard their names before, you're sure to have at least heard their voices, and their inclusion is just another example of how much talent could be squeezed onto a CD-ROM.
Full Throttle was, you know, my project. And so I got the band, the Gone Jackals, which was a big part of the score, and I did all of the ambient music. And we had very simple version of iMuse that could do a transition from one piece to another with a little crossfade while reading it off the CD, which was a little bit of a trick to pull. Because this reading stuff up, we used to say that working with a CD-ROM is kind of like getting champagne out of an oil tanker with a straw. So it was really hard to keep getting the data in where you needed it to play it so that you didn't have glitches.
By the time we got to Full Throttle, which was around 94, I knew that I had to be field recording. I knew that when Ben kicked the door open, that I needed to like get a board and break it in half. In the truck at the end of the, when Mark Hamill is driving, who's the nemesis, is driving the truck, I went out to my pickup truck and deliberately ground the gears with the stick shift and recorded that to have sort of gears and grinding gear sounds. We put a cassette deck recorder, and it was great that it was magnetic tape for the reasons of saturation, but we attached it to the back of a guy's Harley Davidson motorcycle that had straight pipes, meaning no muffler, and every single stroke of that engine was like a cannon literally going off. And so that's Ben's bike, is this guy came by with a chopper, and we had to, it rained, he couldn't go home, and so we had to park it in the LucasArts front lobby, and it dripped oil on the floor. And when people came in Monday morning, there was this big unpainted chopper just sitting in the lobby. So we had so much fun, and we realized that we had to do things in a modest scale, of course, because the formats that our games still in the mid-90s, we were pretty constrained. But we tried to bring a sensibility from the production quality in motion pictures as much as we could. And learning directly from someone like Gary Rydstrom was an amazing opportunity.
Full Throttle was the first game that really employed the digital version of iMuse. And after that was, would it be Monkey 3? And then Grim Fandango was also had a system, a version of the system, and some more elaborate iMuse features. And then another game called X vs. Tie, which was all John Williams music, very carefully cut up into four bar phrases that could be transitioned between very quickly on the fly. It was very cool, technically, a very cool way of doing sort of mix and match action music. And the John Williams battle music from A New Hope, the final battle music, was particularly malleable to that approach.
If you haven't heard the previous parts of this LucasArts special, you can find out a lot more about the company's Star Wars games in the opening episode. The franchise certainly presented an interesting challenge when it came to iMuse and dynamic music. Partly because the original John Williams themes were so well known and well loved. As digital audio became more prominent though, iMuse itself would have to adapt. It wasn't just processing FM synthesis or MIDI anymore, which are somewhat easier to control and manipulate into satisfying transitions. When Grim Fandango released in 1998, the VGM industry had basically accepted formats like Redbook as the norm. Even the N64, the most prominent cartridge-based home console of the time, could pull off some neat tricks with MP3s. But we'll come to that in a future podcast with Robin Beanland and Grant Kirkhope. Since full recordings of real instrumentation, no matter how compressed, are a lot more set in stone than synthesized tones, LucasArts started to use iMuse in some very creative ways.
We did do a beat synchronous transition in Grim when you go into Maximino's office. When you go out of the office, it you get a musical transition to the ending. That was just the only example of that, but we just wanted to do it. It just seemed like the thing to do there. And also in Manny's casino, he can listen to what's going on downstairs. And there's this whole soundscape thing. It's really more of a sound design thing than a musical thing, but where you can go downstairs and hear the band playing. You can go up into Manny's office and it's still playing, but more muffled. And then when you look into his secret spy mechanism that looks at the roulette wheel, it sounds different in a third way. A little bit more clear, but you know, it's to give you that feeling of now I'm sort of peering into this room and the music is coming out of the room through this little hole. So that would be, those are two that I can think of off the top of my head. And those were done, that was done by just parallel crossfading between simultaneously running tracks of different mixes of the music. A lot of what we did with the iMuse system in later stages was make it easier for the composer to use and more intuitive, because in Monkey Island 2, it had a lot of power, but it took basically a composer sitting over the shoulder of a programmer to write all the code that was necessary to do what needed to be done. It was ridiculously inefficient, which, you know, management made no secret of, you know, reminding us about. So we really needed to figure out a way to make it powerful and intuitive, but not, you know. And the other thing is, if it's 3 a.m. and you're cranking away, the last thing you want to do as a composer is open up a script with like C code in it. You don't want to yank yourself over to that side of your brain. You want to stay in the realm of you know, I'm clicking on things, I'm playing notes. And so we had this interface that allowed you to create these buttons, which once you'd coded it up, you could just create a button for a new room and quickly enter data about a piece and transition information. And it was very sort of, you know, WYSIWYG-ish, if you know about WYSIWYG programming. What you see is what you get. So it's a very graphic way of entering. So it was a big improvement in that regard. And you could create these little buttons and then make this map of the game, where you could click on the buttons and go from situation to situation. And the way we used that, I made that map, and then we recorded Tim talking about each room in the game and each situation in the game over bongos. And so we made it like a beatnik's, you know, salon, right? And we had Larry the O, who I quoted earlier about the difference between theory and practice. He played the bongos, and Tim sat and talked about each thing, and then we cut all those up into sound files, and you could press these buttons and hear Tim talking about that room. And then I would replace each of those sound files of Tim talking, I would replace with me humming the theme that was going to be there, just humming it, or maybe playing it on the piano and humming it. In those days, I used a handheld cassette recorder. That was obviously before the days of iPhones. And so you had this nice little noisy handheld cassette recording of me going, and then that would just, I would dump that into the computer, record it directly in real time to the computer, and then chop it up into little MP3 files, or they were probably sound designer files in those days. And you put them, associate them with the button. Now when you press the button, you hear me singing the theme that Tim said, yeah, that sounds like that could be it, you know. And gradually those sound files were replaced with MIDI mockups, and then finally they were replaced with the final production, live recorded jazz musicians. Essentially, the final, if you want to call it the final version of iMuse, when we sort of headed out in 2000, was, you know, sort of a slightly more humble version of what systems like FMOD and WYs are like now.
There was a trip that I took in 1998 from Texas out to California and then Washington, Oregon, which I call the Rolls-Royce Integrator trip, in which I met with the LucasArts team. And this ties in because we talked about something that might happen to iMuse. Then I think I made another trip in 99 and helped actually rework the interface for iMuse for when it was about to possibly come out as a tool that more people could use than just the three of them. And so there was a talk at the Game Developer Conference in 2000 on iMuse just getting ready to come out as a tool that could be licensed and used outside of LucasArts.
Modern-day middleware, such as FMOD and WYs, follows a trail that was truly blazed by iMuse and similar systems through the 90s. But a lot of incredible work has been done to evolve the capabilities of game audio since. Dynamic music and sound has in no way stagnated, and has in fact thrived into a new era of immersion and depth. Clint and Peter have continued their work too, across several projects, including remasters of certain LucasArts classics. Thanks to Double Fine Productions, Day of the Tentacle, Full Throttle, and Grim Fandango all received the remaster treatment, featuring updates to both graphics and sound. To give an added edge of authenticity, Peter and Clint were both brought in to help with those remasters, which were already under the watchful eye of their original designer, Tim Schafer.
I actually had the pleasure of being involved, especially on the Grim Fandango, and what we did, and interestingly, quite similarly, and for different reasons, to what I just talked about with Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb, in that it was a blend or a mixture between music tracks created with a live orchestra and music tracks created in a sampled environment. And so, once again, as is the case in so many things, in TV included, there wasn't budget to do everything live in the Grim Fandango remastered. So Peter worked with Tim Schafer to determine which cues should go to the live orchestra and could be, you know, afforded to produce with a live orchestra. And of course, remembering that when you go to live orchestra, it's not just the cost of the musicians, it's the cost of the orchestrator, the parts extractor, the copyist and duplicator, printer, the engineers, the recording studio, the travel. There's just, once you decide to record with live orchestra, about 10 line items appear on your balance sheet. So they determined that these were the really important cues to do with the live orchestra. And the other cues were split between Peter, myself, and another music specialist named Jeremy at Pyramind Studios in San Francisco, which happens to be right down the street from Double Fine Games. We're responsible to take the original MIDI files that Peter had written back in the late 90s, where the synthesizers and the samplers, of course, couldn't touch the quality of today's sample libraries. And so it was essentially reproducing with today's high-end sample libraries all of the cues that we couldn't afford, and Tim and Pete couldn't afford to send to the live orchestra. So it was a really fun, exciting process of trying to get the clarinet just right, trying to get the strings as realistic as possible, and really ratchet up the quality of those background music tracks. And it was a real blast to work on.
As the gaming industry continues to evolve, music and sound design simply have to grow with it. iMuse was a direct result of that. Just like the Miles sound system and today's complex middleware. The popularization of VR is one of the more recent developments to have a huge impact on audio professionals. Yet, VGM doesn't just react to new technology and trends. In the majority of cases, real progress is made by the creatives themselves, and driven primarily by their own passion and curiosity. Such was the case for practically every employee of LucasArts, perfectly symbolised by the influential success of iMuse.
So these sorts of interactive tricks were all really actually quite sophisticated and creative, especially for the early 90s. And quite frankly, even to this day, for reasons that would be involved to get into, but one of the primary reasons is because music is now audio and has been for, you know, obviously 15, 20 years, but It is in an audio format, not a MIDI format. And so it's more difficult to get a handle on increasingly granular, discrete elements when you're in the audio world. And hopefully that will change as we, and has been changing, and things like grains and other you know, physical modeling even around the corner, and possibly combining MIDI technology with digital audio technology in a way, best of both worlds type of scenario. I think that's where we're going. But back then, it was only MIDI.
All the care, and this was sort of part of the LucasArts, part of the whole LucasArts ethos at the time was, and it came down from on high. There was definitely a sort of a dictum that was established, that was given, that do the very best and coolest stuff you can, and that led to a pretty extraordinary amount of attention to detail. Something like, how does the ad-lib French horn sound in Monkey Island 2 is one little manifestation of that attention to detail.
If you listen to Wing Commander, and I can say this about Dave Govett's music, it sounds a little funny on the MT32. It sounds good for the time. But if you find the version of it where there's a Swedish orchestra playing it for a commencement ceremony, and it also gets played at the Joysticks conference sometimes, there are orchestral arrangements for it, and you listen to those orchestras playing it, and you know what? It sounds beautiful. It stands up to the top tier of game music now, it is a happy thing to me that people are getting to hear it that way. And sometimes I give in to the temptation to feel sorry that Dave didn't get his chance to write for a real orchestra. That instead, the producer said, "Oh, now we've got a budget, let's get real composers." And I feel sometimes like, oh, why did I write all these timbres? Why did I open the doors so that other composers could come into the field? And then I listen to that voice and I say, that voice is a dumb voice. A, I'm really happy that music has, that tools became available to people and that great artists have gotten to write for this medium. B, it would have happened anyway. It didn't happen, it didn't have to be me. And C, it was probably happening somewhere else at the same time, and it wasn't me that was doing it. It's just the evolution of the craft. But I'm happy to say, yes, when I was writing for Two Boops, a Beep, and a Pfft, I tried to write music that would hold up, make people smile, and, what would Zappa write? What would Mozart write? If he had two one-armed, if he had two violin players and a one-armed drummer, and a one-fingered keyboard player who were really fast, so I always tried to challenge myself that way, and it was the notes were very important to me, even when tones started to become available.
Thanks to George, Clint, and Peter for speaking to me for the sound test. But thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. There are still many episodes to come in this second series, and the first season is freely available through most popular podcast providers. Now all three parts of my LucasArts special are released. Look forward to a potentially two-part exploration of that game company, with both Vincent Diamonte and Austin Wintory. Of course, we'll delve into their beautiful soundtracks for Flower and Journey, but we'll also discuss the developer's entire catalogue of games, from Genova Chen's student project, Cloud, to Sky, Children of the Light. Between them, Vincent and Austin have composed music for every That Game Company release, and you'll even hear once more from Clint Bajakian, who worked as a manager for Flower and Journey. If you'd like to hear my interviews early, ahead of public release, head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave. There, you can pledge your support for as little as a single pound or dollar, to unlock unedited conversations, full quality WAV files, a backlog of otherwise unavailable live shows, and more. Either way, I hope you enjoyed this edition of ST2, and don't forget to join me for the next episode.